Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, March the 29th. As we heard in state news, the retiring Supreme Court Justice John Wilcox is concerned about the tone of the current race for state Supreme Court justice and is hoping for some reforms that might change that in the future. Meanwhile, a new slate of TV ads, what some would call negative TV ads in the state Supreme Court race, are rolling out fast this week. At least five new ads hit the airwaves in the past couple of days. One of the ads, from candidate Annette Ziegler, a Washington County judge, attacks her opponent, Madison attorney Linda Clifford, saying that Clifford would rule on cases that would benefit her trial attorney husband. Ziegler has been the target of ads from Clifford and her supporters questioning her judicial ethics and conflicts of interest. So why has this supposedly nonpartisan race become so partisan? Many believe it is because the court is equally divided between conservatives and liberals, and the next justice will help determine the balance of the court. We will talk with two guests about this race and the issue specifically of judicial activism during this hour, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guests. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll free from anywhere. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Our first guest is Rick Essenberg. He's an attorney practicing in Milwaukee. He's also an adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School, and he wrote a piece for the Federalist Society called A Court Unbound, The Recent Jurisprudence of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us. So you think that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is turning into or already is an activist court?
I think, you know, we use the term activist and restraint, and you know, they're not perfect terms, but I do think that they sum up something that's going on. And what is going on is that there is increasingly an ability of four justices on the court to expand legal doctrine, the rules by which they approach cases, in a way which maximizes judicial authority and threatens to impinge upon the prerogatives of the legislative and executive branch. And although we think of these things as liberal and conservative because, you know, recently in our history, you know, judicial activism is associated with decisions which bring about results that people on the left tend to prefer. That's not really what we're talking about here, because in our legal history, judicial activism has been just as likely to advance causes which are preferred by people on the right. And what we're calling for here is sort of a return to an approach to judging which roots decision making in the text of the law, statutes or constitution that have at some point been consented to by the governed.
Yeah. Just to clarify, there are, you say, four justices currently on the state Supreme Court who you and others believe are legislating from the bench?
Well, they are, that's sort of a common phrase that we use. I think that what they're doing is they're expanding their authority in a way which moves them beyond a simple interpretation of the statute and the Constitution. For example, you know, we hear a lot about this case that was decided a couple years ago, which struck down limits on damages in medical malpractice cases.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about that case and what's concerning about it is not whether or not we have medical malpractice damage caps. I mean, the legislature thought it was a good idea. They adopted it. They're the people that we elect to make those decisions. What's concerning about the case is that the court announced a change in the way that it was going to review laws of that type. And if it is serious about what it said, and if it does it again, virtually any piece of legislation could be found to be unconstitutional, because what the court has announced it's going to do is it's going to very aggressively re-examine the legislature's claims of the connection between the goal of the law and whether or not the law actually accomplishes that goal. That's really an extraordinary development. That may be the most significant case in decision in the court's history, but it's because of the approach they take. It's about who gets to decide and not the particular decision that was made.
Yeah. I'm going to check our weather forecast, and then we'll continue talking about judicial activism versus judicial restraint and how that applies to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and what it means for also this race currently going on for state Supreme Court in Wisconsin. And we welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Do you agree that the current Wisconsin Supreme Court is practicing judicial activism, or at least most of the justices are? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock right now. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben's guest says there is a corrupt process through which economic hitmen manipulate the global economy for the benefit of the corporate elite. That's the topic of discussion after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking this hour about judicial activism, what some people say are judges or justices legislating from the bench rather than simply interpreting the law. Our guest, Rick Essenberg, an attorney practicing in Milwaukee, also an adjunct professor at the Marquette University Law School, wrote a piece about this for the Federalist Society. It was entitled A Court Unbound, The Recent Jurisprudence of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in which he argues that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is more and more an activist court. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We have open lines right now. Does this mean this is a little bit esoteric, a little bit over your head? Is this an issue that concerns you, judges legislating from the bench? Rick Essenberg, let me ask you about that last case you just talked about and how you think that this the justices ruled in a way that was activist. In that malpractice cap case, weren't they simply saying that the caps placed by the legislature were unconstitutional? Isn't that what the court is supposed to do?
Well, but why were they unconstitutional, I think, is the question. And, you know, given the fact that we have open lines, I hate to get even more esoteric, but they decided that case under the Equal Protection Clause of the Wisconsin Constitution.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Constitution
sure,
says...
Sure, and courts have always struggled with how to interpret the Equal Protection Clause, because we don't, you know... Laws make distinctions all the time. I can practice law. Joy, I assume that you're not a lawyer. You
no.
can't. People who are over 21 can drink. People who are under 21 cannot. And the way that courts have dealt with that is they have generally accorded legislatures a great deal of deference unless they're drawing a distinction based on a classification that is called suspect, that is race, gender, something like that. The Supreme Court in this Ferdin case, the malpractice cap case, said this doesn't involve a suspect class. It's just an ordinary garden variety classification. But then they went on and decided that what the legislature did was irrational. But it took them 79 paragraphs to explain why. If something truly is irrational, and this wasn't even close, Why would it take 79 paragraphs to explain that? What the court has done is sort of taken, put itself in the position, if it means what it said in that case, of sort of being this super legislature which will take before it the laws that our democratically elected representatives pass and decide whether they think they're a good idea or not. And that's troubling. That's troubling because it really goes to the structure of our government and who gets to decide. It really isn't about malpractice cats. It's about the proper role of the court.
Well, we do have some callers now, so let me go to Joe in La Crosse. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Thanks, Joy. I think in the long run, I think that the situation that the courts find themselves in, particularly things like the Supreme Court decisions, is something that's a perfectly natural evolution of what began, you know, 200 and almost 250 years ago. I think the founding fathers and the whole system up until now has been predicated on the understanding that at some point the judiciary would be the only branch between a tyrannical administrative executive and a Congress that was out of control or not functioning the way it was designed, and that it would be necessary for the judicial to step in and protect the rights of an unrepresented minority. In a representative democracy, there's always going to be a minority. And I think they understood that at some point, if there weren't a judicial to balance things out, that would not take place, that eventually there'd be a concentration of power as we have in this country today in the hands of a few, and that if it weren't for the courts to be able to legislate and say, hey, you know what, that's not a good idea, hey, you know what, that's a really bad plan, that's what we would see. And I don't have a problem with that in the long term. And the idea of an activist judiciary, I think I'm okay with that, because at some point there has to be somebody that steps in and says the Constitution is not a static piece of paper. It's an ongoing thing. And does it evolve? It has to, because we've changed. The situation isn't the same as it was. We managed to declare that slavery was unconstitutional. We managed to declare that 100 other things that we thought were perfectly reasonable back then are not so reasonable now. And unless we have something that's fluid, unless we have something that's flexible, we have the potential for real disaster.
Mm-hmm. Rick Essenberg?
Well, it's a good statement of the counterargument. Good job, Joe. I'm not persuaded, and there are a couple of things that I'd like to unpack there. I mean, yes, the judiciary does act as as something that protects minorities, but only when it should only do that when the Constitution directs it to, because when it does that, when it tells the legislature or the executive, who are politically, democratically elected branches, that you can't do something, it's acting as a counter-democratic institution. Sometimes it has to do that, but it needs to have clear legal warrant before it does that. We often hear this idea that the Constitution should be allowed to breathe, you know, it's sort of anthropomorphication of the Constitution. But, of course, the Constitution doesn't breathe. It doesn't get up. It doesn't walk around. It doesn't do Pilates. The only way that it can be made to breathe is by judges reading into it what they want to read into it. And I'm not comfortable with the idea of being ruled by, certainly on the federal level, a group of unelected, on the state level, a group of people who run only 10 years and every 10 years and who, because of the conventions of judicial elections, are generally not permitted to say what they think when they do run for office. I don't want to be ruled by a group of royal tribunes who get to decide what they think is right or not, and so I think this question of restraint, and it's not simple. I mean, it's not a mechanical task. I mean, we can disagree about what the Constitution requires, but what I hope we can agree on is that judges should be about interpreting and applying texts, that they should be limiting themselves to what is actually in or fairly inferable from the text.
Let me ask you, Rick Essenberg, you wrote in your piece, the court is now more or less evenly divided between two groups of justices who have dramatically different notions of the role of the judiciary. Who are the justices on both sides?
Most people would say that, and these are two groups of equally intelligent, honest, people who are acting in good faith, that uh, the the more activist judges are Chief Justice Abramson and Justices Bradley and Butler. You see sort of on the other side, Justice Wilcox and Rogensack sort of typically voting together in, you know, sharply divided cases, with Justice Prosser and Justice Crooks sort of being the swing justice, Justice Prosser perhaps voting more often with Wilcox and Rogensack, Crooks recently perhaps more often with the other three.
Yeah, and the thought is, the conventional wisdom is that Madison attorney Linda Clifford, candidate for state Supreme Court, would be an activist, and Washington County Judge Annette Ziegler would be one that would use judicial restraint?
I'm not here for either candidate. I will agree that that is the conventional wisdom. That's what most people seem to think.
Yeah. Jeff in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I just think that this, you know, the term activist judges is thrown around really in both parties, and I think it's more of a symptom and not the disease. I think the disease is that we don't have independent judges anymore. You know, and I'm a layman. I have no idea how to fix that, but that's just as, you know, when I read the newspapers, when I watch the ads on the TV and hear the news stories, I just do not think that any of these people are independent anymore, and that really disappoints me.
You want to react to that, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, judicial independence is very important, but it comes at a price. It, you know, as Justice Scalia says, you know, judges have traditionally been independent because people think we're doing lawyers' work up here. We're reading text and we're interpreting them and we're applying them. But when judges take upon themselves the right to expand doctrine in a way that I think has happened recently in our state Supreme Court, or when they find rights and limitations on the government which are not in the Constitution at all, as I think has occurred on the United States Supreme Court level with the right to privacy, then people look at what the courts are doing and they say, well, why should they be independent? They're just political actors like the rest of us. They're just imposing their policy preferences, and we ought to treat them like any other set of politicians. And and there's a cost to be paid for that, because, and the cost is this idea of judicial independence. You can't have it both ways.
We will try one more quickie. Jim in East Troy. Hi, you're on the air.
Very, very good topic. I was wondering what your second previous caller was drinking out there in La Crosse. I find it amazing that we would want to advocate having the judicial branch be, unelected, and then basically making laws. I mean, that kind of thinking is scary to me. And the reality is the way that at a federal level, even right now, I mean, there isn't one party in charge. Congress is back to being, you know, one political spectrum, and you can have your political argument about the presidency. But, you know, it's scary to think that people actually think that the judges, in my mind, that judges should be activists.
Yeah.
That is, you know, where are we headed then?
Well, you know what? We don't have time for a response. I apologize, Rick Essenberg, but that's basically your concern too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rick Essenberg, attorney practicing in Milwaukee. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Thursday morning, March the 29th at 7:36. We'll continue our discussion this hour on judicial activism and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We heard in our last half hour from Rick Essenberg, who is an attorney practicing in Milwaukee and also is an adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School. He wrote a piece for the Federalist Society that was entitled A Court Unbound, the Recent Jurisprudence of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in which he argued that the Wisconsin Supreme Court, or at least most of the justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, are practicing judicial activism, what is commonly referred to as legislating from the bench. In his piece, he wrote, recently, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has shown a willingness to abandon long-accepted principal constraints on the court's use of power in adopting an extraordinarily aggressive form of equal protection analysis. It has substantially weakened the presumption that the statutes are constitutional. Rick Essenberg also saying that this type of activism is dangerous to democracy. We will get a different perspective on the balance of the state Supreme Court and whether it is an activist court or not with Howard Schwaber during this half hour. He's an associate professor of political science and an affiliate member of the law school at UW-Madison, and will continue to take your questions and comments and your viewpoints on this. Is this something that concerns you? Do you think that our Wisconsin Supreme Court is legislating from the bench? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Professor Schwaber, good morning.
Good morning.
So do you think that Wisconsin Supreme Court is legislating from the bench?
Well, there's a couple of things one has to work out before answering that question. Mr. Eisenberg's white paper makes several different claims or several different arguments that provide the basis for his assertion that what's going on here is an impermissible form of judicial activism. Really, they come down to three claims. First, that the court is relying on social scientific evidence to reach conclusions about the desirability or rationality of various policies. Second, that the court is making broad rules that apply to a range of cases rather than restricting itself to the case before it. And third, that the court is being more aggressive than he thinks that they should be in second-guessing the legislature. And the equal protection case that you mentioned is the highlighting case of that phenomenon, in his view, in which he argues that the court is applying what's called rational basis with teeth. That is, where a law does not affect a constitutional right or a constitutionally suspect class, there's a tradition of a presumption of constitutionality that the court should err on the side of assuming that the legislature got it right on constitutional grounds. And he's suggesting that they're not doing that.
Yeah, and what would you suggest?
Well, first of all, he has some good points. But the most striking thing that I would suggest is that this entire white paper is essentially a campaign advertisement for Ned Ziegler.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, the paper is coming out just a few weeks before the election, and the framing of the issues, the selection of the issues, and the entire mode of the presentation closely mimics the campaign themes of Ziegler's campaign. One of the ironies in this white paper to me is that Eisenberg warns us against the politicization of the bench. This looks to me like precisely an exercise of politicization of judicial elections, extending lobbying electioneering into a new avenue, using a purportedly academic setting like the Federalist Society for overtly political ends. And so I think there's a certain irony there. If this paper had come out a month from now, frankly, after the election is over, I would view it with a somewhat less jaundiced eye. But at the moment, I have trouble separating my cynical suspicions about its motivations from its content.
Yeah, and certainly Mr. Eisenberg did say that, you know, I'm not here to speak for or against either of the candidates, but this has been, these issues have been an issue in this state Supreme Court race, and that's one of the reasons why we also wanted to have two different guests looking into this. There have been charges that Madison attorney Linda Clifford would be, according to supporters of Ziegler, a liberal activist on the bench. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that's an awfully good question. And I think Eisenberg's treatment of the issue in his paper is actually fairly good. There are a couple of different ways of thinking about judicial activism. The simplest one is that we call judges activists if they are eager to overturn laws passed by the legislature or to reinterpret laws passed by the legislature. So in one sense, and I think the simplest sense, judicial activism refers to relationships between the branches of government, and you might call it judicial aggressiveness, perhaps, in that respect. Ironically, among U.S. Supreme Courts, if one measures activism that way, the most aggressive or most activist court in our history has been the Rehnquist Court. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to trouble the Federalist Society in the past, because the Rehnquist Court has been activist in a direction of which they approve. So, again, the Federalist Society does not come to this issue with perfectly clean and principled heads. Which does not do anything to strengthen or weaken the case being made here. It's just one of those ironies that I can't resist. Another way of thinking about judicial activism is the willingness or eagerness of judges to depart from established precedents. And Eisenberg talks about this as well in the white paper. That is, there's a principle called stare decisis, which said that a court should have a good reason for departing from past rulings. That doesn't mean we have to be stuck with past wrong decisions, but sort of like the presumption of constitutionality, that the court should err on the side of consistency unless there's a good reason not to. And a third form of judicial activism people talk about is much more a matter of opinion, and that is people use the phrase judicial activism to describe courts or judges who, in their view, depart from the meaning of the Constitution or the laws that they're interpreting. And so judicial activism is a name of an accusation reaching beyond the text and importing a judge's own views into the argument. All three of those accusations are in the white paper in one form or another, but the biggest issues around which they're couched have to do with the issues that are at the heart of the current campaign, caps on tort liability and treatment of criminal defendants, both of which are the main themes of Ziegler's election campaign.
Yeah. We're going to... actually, I'm going to take a call. Bernie in Whitewater. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning to you both. 2 points. The first is that I think in the vernacular, at least to me, judicial activism is usually used as a negative term when one disagrees with what the court is doing. And myself, the second point, I guess, is with respect to these campaigns, I know that, I'd like to know, I see a lot of problems with liberties being eroded over the years from what, you know, the U.S. Constitution says, and I see a lot of problems with whoever has the most money, whether it's a corporation or whatever, generally prevailing in the court system. And I'd like to know what a Supreme Court justice candidate, where they stand on issues. And I know there's this rule that says you can't talk about any issue you might rule on. I think that's a rule. So therefore, you don't get any information. And to me, everybody's got views. To go through this farce of pretending they don't have views, and if they speak about it publicly, that will cause some sort of a bias, to me is ridiculous because they already have the bias. They already have the views. I have my views. I'd love to see that change where they can say, somebody can say, hey, I think the Constitution says you should have concealed carry. It shouldn't even have to be a law. I'd like to hear what they have to say about it, et cetera, et cetera. Just curious your thoughts on that.
Well, there's a lot in that question. First of all, in terms of judicial campaigns, it's a good point. The problem is there's a good countervailing point, which is that we do have this assumption that when parties go to court, their case is being heard by a judge who hasn't already decided which side should win. And to have judicial candidates say, I will rule in the following way on some set of cases, I will always rule in favor of someone's right to carry weapons, or I will always rule against someone's right to use tax shelters, or whatever it is, sets a situation which is unwholesome in two ways. First, that litigants coming into court are faced with a judge whom they have good reason to believe is prejudiced against them, or conversely, mm-hmm. take advantage of a judge who is friendly. And secondly, it causes the judicial election to become indistinguishable from other forms of election. That is, it becomes pure policy-based politics. And we do still cling to the notion, and I think Eisenberg was absolutely right on this point, that judging ought to be something different from simply an expression of the judge's policy preferences, in a way that serving a legislature is not. Now, I think the caller's name was Bernie. He makes the point that he doesn't believe it. He thinks there's a certain hypocrisy at work there, and that he wants to know where judges stand because he feels that will dictate how they're going to rule in practice. That may be true. There's some evidence that that's true. There's some evidence that it's not, or that it's at least limited. Where Eisenberg's point is very strong, I think, is in his suggestion that the fact or the perception that that is going on is unwholesome for the judiciary. Where he's less strong is in his particular cases and his selection of arguments with respect to justices on the Wisconsin court.
Yeah, let me check weather, and then we'll continue talking with Howard Schwaber, Associate Professor of Political Science and affiliate member of the law school at UW-Madison, talking with him about issues in the race for state Supreme Court and The ideas presented by our guest in our last half hour on judicial activism, and our guest in our last half hour who said that the Wisconsin Supreme Court was becoming an activist court. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and concerns and issues. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 8 o'clock this morning, we'll talk with a couple of guests about living with cancer, not dying from cancer, living with cancer, following the announcements in the past week or so of two high-profile people, Elizabeth Edwards and White House Press Secretary Tony Snow, announcing a reoccurrence of cancer. So we'll talk about coping with cancer coming up after 8 o'clock. We're talking about the race for state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, the current makeup of the state Supreme Court, and whether or not it's an activist court, as our guest in our last half hour was arguing. Our guest right now is Howard Schwaber, Associate Professor of Political Science and affiliate member of the law school at UW-Madison. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Professor Schwaber, another thing that Bernie said, our caller before the weather break, was that he thinks that activist judge or activist court is a convenient term, something that you would say, that you would call a judge an activist judge if you disagree with the ruling of that judge. Is that about it?
Well, that does tend to be how it's used. On the other hand, the term, as I tried to suggest earlier, does have some uses that can be rendered reasonably objective. That is, you can ask, for example, how frequently does a judge vote to overrule the legislature on the grounds of questioning the legislature's judgments on matters of fact? That's a good example. The Rehnquist Court, for example, has been tremendously activist with respect to Congress that way, on questions of commerce power, for example, taking it upon themselves to decide that Congress was wrong to conclude from the evidence before it that something was or was not part of commerce. Some of the cases Eisenberg points to shows the Wisconsin court recently, in the last couple of terms, doing similar things. That is, reviewing social scientific evidence and concluding that the legislature was mistaken in its evaluation of the consequences of an action. Now, whether that's a bad thing really does get, well, one has to go case by case, but does get to the question of the role of the court. At some level, if the legislature's evidence or basis for making a policy is not sensibly connected to its goal, that's what we mean by rational basis. The lowest level of scrutiny we have is that we always ask courts to review what a legislature has done and ask whether the evidence it's citing or the logic that it's using is sensible in connection with the goal that it claims to be pursuing. There's no one doubts that it is appropriate for a court to ask that question. Eisenberg has some good evidence that in several cases the Wisconsin court recently has gone beyond that to the point of substituting its judgment on those questions of fact underlying the effects of policies. And those I thought were some of his stronger points. In that respect, it's noteworthy that the retiring justice is Justice Wilcox, who's part of a bloc, what we think of as the conservative bloc on the court, and that in the instance of these caps on liability cases and criminal procedure cases, which are the two that are most at issue in this election, he has been a dissenting voice. That is, he has been a voice that argued for greater deference to the legislature. That's why the Wisconsin Manufacturing Association, for example, is backing Judge Ziegler for his spot, because they believe that she would likewise be inclined to support the pro-business legislature, and that's why there are these letters and things going around accusing Linda Clifford of being a liberal activist in order to bring up the specter that she would increase the tendency of the Wisconsin court to resist the legislature's effort to cap recovery for liabilities.
Yeah. Let me ask you, since it's somewhat related here, about one of the new ads that candidate Ziegler has out.
Is this the one with the full moon?
Oh, not the werewolf one. I don't think it's the werewolf one. Where there's it is. Well, maybe it does bring this up, but it's uh, it uh, It is accusing Madison attorney Linda Clifford of having a conflict of interest, saying she would rule on cases that would benefit her husband, who is a trial attorney, and insinuating that Linda Clifford, in these cases of, you know, whatever, liability reform or tort reform or malpractice caps, really, you know, would have a bias because her husband's an attorney dealing with those cases.
Well, there's a classic election tactic, which is if you know you're vulnerable on an issue, accuse your opponent of the same thing first. That way you can insist that they're only bringing it up to get back at you. Ziegler, in fact, has enormous conflict of interest problems. She ruled on a huge number of cases involving businesses in which she and her husband are, in which her husband is a paid trustee, or involving a bank that had loaned her household very large sums of money. There are very serious questions about her ethics as a sitting judge on literally just well, I believe it's 121 cases in total. There's been a whole series of reports in the papers about this question. The Ziegler campaign is trying to preempt that issue by raising the specter of a hypothetical situation in which rulings from the bench would affect the career of Linda Clifford's husband. In one sense, right, taken seriously, that argument would mean no judge could ever be married to a lawyer, mm-hmm. since by definition, what judges do affect the, in some indirect way, affect the careers of lawyers. There's a very sharp distinction here. Ziegler is accused of conflicts of interest that rise to the level of unethical behavior, at a minimum. Linda Clifford is being accused of effectively being married to a lawyer.
Yeah, but Linda Clifford apparently said that she would not necessarily step down from cases involving these types of issues. Would a Supreme Court judge have to do that? If
no, yeah. Absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, certainly a justice would be required to recuse herself from a case in which her spouse were appearing as counsel.
Yeah.
Similarly, a justice, there are ethical guidelines that suggest a Wisconsin justice should recuse herself from any case involving a business in which she owns more than $50,000 of stock. That's one of the issues that arose with Ziegler. But it is frankly preposterous to suggest that a justice should recuse herself from any case involving any issue of law that might affect the work of any lawyer if she happens to be related to a lawyer.
Sarah in Lodi is with us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I guess I have never been so confused about a Supreme Court judge race ever, and I think it's because of the ad campaigns. It's just really made me feel very negative about the election for Supreme Court judges in our state. It has become just another negative campaign in hundreds of them with people running for anything. And I guess I agree with Bernie that just because someone has a personal opinion doesn't mean they can't do their job. And I think nowadays we allow people to do those things, whether we disagree with birth control and we're a pharmacist, but we don't need to fill birth control. We've accepted that job, and we should do what our job says we should do. And I think as a society, we're just not able to allow people to have personal opinions and then think that they, as professionals, can do a job that they're supposed to do based on the rule, the law, yeah. or whatever the job mandates are that they accept. And I just would like a comment. I'll take it off the air.
Mm-hmm. I think both of those observations are exactly right. First, that this judicial election has become, to call it political and negative is a dramatic understatement. I referred a moment ago to a television advertisement I've seen from the Ziegler campaign in which Linda Clifford's face is shown against a full moon with the sound of a howling wolf in the background, literally a werewolf image, which is almost laughably...
Yeah, and the text had looked like horror movie text with blood running down the letters.
Right, and it is not presenting itself as humorous, it's presenting itself as be afraid of this woman, which has to be a new low, not only in judicial campaigning, but I should think in political campaigning in Wisconsin in general. We can get back to talking about the campaigns. I think, though, that the caller just made an extraordinarily important point, and one that I've been thinking about quite a lot, which is that if you ask, in very broad terms, if you ask what's gone wrong with things like judicial elections, and to another a lesser extent, perhaps our politics in general, I think one shorthand way of describing it is that we have lost sight of the division between a person's personal life and their professional responsibilities. On the one hand, people resent being told they have to leave some of their personal beliefs at home. People say, you know, if I am a religious person, or if I am, for that matter, or if I'm an atheist, or if I have deep beliefs, I should not be told that I ought not to let them come into bear in my professional life because I'm a public servant. I should run for office based on my character and my beliefs, and then in office, I should carry out my office in a way that fulfills those beliefs.
Professor Schwaber, we have less than 30 seconds.
I'm sorry. Very briefly, I think that's extraordinarily unhealthy, and I think the fact that it's seeped into judicial elections is a good way of seeing just how unhealthy it is.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Howard Schwaber, Associate Professor of Political Science, affiliate member of the Law School at UW-Madison. A reminder that We the People Wisconsin, that's the civic journalism project that Wisconsin Public Radio is involved in, will be presenting another debate between the two candidates for state Supreme Court. It will be on Friday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear it here on the Ideas Network or watch it on Wisconsin Public Television. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.